This is an interview with Tony Gates, manager of radio station WFAH, and we're going to talk a little bit about the history of WFAH radio. And Tony, when did the radio station get started?
We went on the air first March 26, 1947, and it was an FM only at the time.
Now, WFAH was one of the first FMs in Ohio, wasn't it?
That's right. One of the first commercial FM stations in northeastern Ohio. In fact, we like to think it was the first because of the date. And if you go checking some of the other dates of early FMs around the area, you'll find we're right up there among the first, at least.
Now, FM was sort of a new thing, and I can remember down at Sears and Roebuck, they had a big blue radio with a silver cloth cover over the speaker, and they were selling FM radios because FM was very new. Did you have very many listeners when you went on the day?
We had very few listeners. As a matter of fact, the only way we could get any listeners was to kind of promote the sale of FM radios. And I remember the old Pilot radios that Cope Electric, we bought them and provided them to Cope Electric to sell, so then promoted them so that people would buy them and we'd have listeners.
Now that was sort of the converter type of thing.
No, there was also a Pilot converter, but that was a Pilot radio itself, one of the first. I guess Pilot was really a pioneer in the FM receivers.
I remember my neighbors had an FM, and we'd go over and listen to the high school band and some of the programs that were local to the neighbor's house.
Yeah. Well, you see, what happened, before the war, there was FM. Major Armstrong developed the FM system. And before the war, they had set aside a certain band for FM. After the war, they decided to change that. And the FMs that had been on the air prior to the war then had to convert and change frequencies. Naturally, the people that had bought any kind of a set radio that had the old frequency for FM on it, they could no longer get it because the frequency was changed. So we had a real problem, and it was right after the war. Not much had been done to develop FM.
Of course, TV wasn't around at that time.
No, it wasn't.
The radio was still pretty big.
I remember, though, that TV was in the experimental stage when I was in college back in the 30s. I remember seeing a telecast in Princeton, New Jersey, where RCA had its research and development program going. I remember seeing they had a television set up in a store. I think it was in 1937. And here was a wrestling match, and they had it in the window of the store. I remember seeing that. So it was under development even before the war, but it, after the war, it hadn't yet taken hold.
Now, Tony, you're not an Alliance native. Well, you are now, but you weren't originally from Alliance or from over in Pennsylvania. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about how you ended up here in Alliance and became the manager of the radio station.
Well, I was born in Hanover, Pennsylvania, which is in the old Pennsylvania Dutch area in southeastern Pennsylvania. I went to Westminster Choir College in Princeton, New Jersey during the 30s. Graduated from there as a choral director and had a job in Worcester, Ohio, directing church music at the Worcester Methodist Church. Then the draft came along, and that's where I ended. After the war, I found that I could no longer support a family on what the Worcester Church was able to pay. So I looked around for a further job, which ended me here in Alliance at the First Methodist Church here. I lived with that for about a year, and the new FM station was starting. I applied for a job. I got it. It was kind of interesting. Mrs. F.A. Hoyles was chairman of the music committee at the church, and she was also president of the Review Publishing Company, which was starting the radio station. It was a little delicate switching from one job to the other with her as the head both places.
The boss of both places.
She's a lovely lady, and we got it worked out, and I've been with the company ever since.
Some people might be interested in knowing what WFAH stands for.
Frank Austin Hoyles. And the W, of course, everything east of the Mississippi River, the call letters start with W, everything west is X, right?
Right.
Okay.
Okay. Okay.
Okay, yeah, I don't know what I was thinking. Yeah, okay. Right.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the personnel with the radio station and who's been in charge through the years.
I think we ought to say that the Review Publishing Company applied for the license to put in the station. They felt it was a natural adjunct to the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Reed had returned from the war as a major in the Army. He had been with the Review Publishing Company prior to entering service. When he came back, Arthur Hoyles was president of the Review Publishing Company, and he got Paul, and they developed this FM application and put the station on the air. They used the old Hoyles home at the corner of South Union and Milton. The only way they could, after the war, the only way they could get authorization to build anything commercial was to provide veterans housing with it. So they put housing for veterans on the top floors and remodeled the bottom so that they could have the radio station in there.
Now the tower was there also, the transmitting
tower. Well, it was an FM and a single tower, and that's right. They put the tower right in the back.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall the first day the WFAH was on the air?
I sure do. Well, as I say, Paul Reed was our manager of the station, and Bob Hansen, who came here from Marshfield, Wisconsin, was the program director. He was a very good radio man. He had not a whole lot of actual experience, but he went to the University of Wisconsin in their radio department and came to Alliance.
In those days, they didn't just play records and give the news and that sort of thing, did they?
Well, no. You see, what we did, everything was formal, and it had to be written out ahead of time. I recall starting to work the 1st of January, but we didn't go on the air till March 27th, and I had plenty to do writing scripts. And in those days, we had rental libraries of music. There was a World Library and the Langworth Library, for instance, that we had. And they had the big 16-inch records. And then you'd go and pick out the songs that you wanted to play, but you wrote out everything that the announcer was going to say. And we wrote scripts for 3 months there before we went on the air so that we had a good backlog. Well, they'd be 15-minute or half-hour programs, not like today where we start at 6 o'clock in the morning, and it's one program practically all day long with little features thrown in. We didn't do it that way. For instance, we started out at 10 o'clock in the morning the first day with the World News resume, and that was a 15-minute news presentation. Came off the Associated Press wire service. Then we had music for Wednesday that first day.
must have signed on Wednesday, right?
right, and it was it was a half hour. We then had a 15-minute program, Lest We Forget. This was a public service feature, Institute for Democratic Education. Then we had a little feature story off the wire service. And then we had a program called Moments of Melody. That was a 25-minute program. Then Headline News, and we had a program, we couldn't think of any other title, we called it Little Show. And it was all just music off of these big records, you know, mm-hmm. and with a script to go with it. Then Elizabeth Larson, who became Stevenson later on, had a program which was called Stairway of Stars. And that was sponsored by Cope Furniture Company, by the way. We had the Ohio Farmer in those days off the wire service, too. That was a 15-minute program. No, that was only 5 minutes. On the Farm Front followed, and it was 15 minutes. And we had a little bit of country music, too, Old Chisholm Trail, sponsored by the Camera Shop. You remember Pinky on Main Street?
Pinky's Camera Shop.
Yeah, and then Elizabeth Larson had Here's to the Ladies. Jim Burnett was one of our first day people.
Now he's news director now at WHBC.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. So we had the people on the air were Elizabeth Larson, Tony Gates, Jim Burnett, Bob Hansen. But everything was kind of blocked out in 15 or half hour segments. We signed off then later in the day at 2 o'clock and came back on at 5. So we'd go 4 hours and then we'd lay out and then we'd come back for 4 hours. We couldn't afford to go all day.
Couldn't write scripts fast enough. Right?
It was kind of interesting that the first day's revenue was $31.80. I know it didn't pay for all the salaries.
I know one of the interesting programs over the years that you had was called Breakfast with Your Neighbor. Is that the name of the program?
That's right. Breakfast with Your Neighbors was a an in-the-home kind of broadcast. We bought a mobile unit from WJW up in Cleveland, an old unit that they had. And I remember Artie McCracken, who was one of our engineers, and I used to go out every morning to somebody's home. Or sometimes we went, like, to the fire department, various places for 6 months, 6 days a week. Uh-huh. We had breakfast somewhere.
This was all live.
And it was live, mostly all live. A few that we had to tape ahead of time because it just didn't fit in with the whatever we were trying to do. But mostly it was live. And I do recall Artie McCracken saying that one morning, I believe we were out at McCarty's place, Bill McCarty, and after the program he told me that during the broadcast there had been a riverboat down on the Mississippi River calling Memphis right in on our frequency.
So you had calling Memphis
all
throughout the program.
Memphis. That's right.
You mentioned Jim Burnett's name, and Jim is over at WHBC, and I know that over the years, WFAH for many years fed personnel to WHBC in Canton, and it got to the point where just about their entire staff came from Alliance, and I think you gave them some buttons or something, name tags or something.
Well, one time I kind of got sick of their raiding our staff. So I had name tags made up for all the people who were then at WHBC who had been alumni of this station and sent them over and put on WFAH alumni. They had the name and WFAH alumni on it.
Most of the staff wore those, probably.
There were a lot of them, I know. Seven or eight, I think, at the time. Well, Paul Gilmore, who is now president of the company over there and manages WHBC, had been a sales manager with us, and not exactly right at the beginning. Fred Joseph had been in charge of sales for us when we first started on the air. But soon afterward, they got Paul in, and he stayed with us a couple of years. There were so many people, Jim Burnett and Bob Kraling and Ed Kraling and,
Bill Steffi and Bill Glasser.
That's right. So over the years, I wish I could remember them all, but there were many, many that have gone over there.
Mm-hmm. Early management of the station, or early people that worked for the station, you mentioned a few of them.
Dick Probst was our chief engineer and got us on the air. And I mentioned Artie McCracken. Mm-hmm. He was one of the first ones. Gertrude Pearson was our bookkeeper and secretary, and she stayed with us until 1962. She got married and moved away, and we lost her. I think that was just about the staff.
Mm-hmm. Now, the station started out on South Union Avenue in the Hoyles home, and that was in the 40s, and then in the 50s, being you started as an FM, you added an AM station. When did this all take place?
The AM went on the air September 3rd, 1953. And, of course, we used we bought the property from the Smith Farm on Smith Avenue, 9 acres in the plot here where we are currently. And we couldn't put up an AM station inside the city. We had to have three towers erected in order to get a pattern for our AM. So they bought this just outside the city, and eventually we put the FM in with it on the center tower, right?
Mm-hmm. And then did the studios and everything move out to Smith Avenue, to that location?
Not until 1962. We had two what we call balanced telephone lines to send our programming. The reason for two was that in case something went bad with one, we had a standby.
Let's talk a little bit about the first studio in the Hoyles home. Maybe you could give us a little tour of what facilities there were.
Well, we had two studios. One, the large studio, Studio A, that's always called Studio A, your largest one, had been sunken from, that isn't the way I want to say it, but the dining area of the old Hoyles home was sunken in down to 4 or 5 feet below its level, and that formed Studio A, gave a ceiling height and what we felt we needed. There was a smaller studio which was used as a utility practically all the time when we weren't doing some live programming or whatever in the other studio, and we had a control room. The living room and front entrance way were made into offices and lobby. The kitchen was turned into an office for the manager, and the garage was turned into working area for the staff, newsroom, etc.
And it was a pretty good studio, very nicely done.
Yes, the company spent a lot of money for the architectural design on it, and however, it got too costly eventually when we had the AM out here, so we decided to combine the two, bring the studio, the offices out here too.
And what year was did that happen, did you say?
1962.
1962.
Right.
And maybe you could give us a little visual tour of the studios on Smith Avenue.
Well, to begin with, when we put the AM out here, we just had to have a transmitter shack. Well, the company built more than a shack. It was about a 30 by 30 one-room building, really. So when we decided to move our studios and offices out here, we hired an architect to design from our drawings effective studio and office space. And I think most people have been in it, been through our station, but in the front, all the offices are located on the Smith side of the building. And the working area is combined. We have one, two, three studios, one control room, and a newsroom that are all in a very close area for ease of operation. The old building was used then mostly as a transmitter building and combined with the newer offices.
Now, 1962 was the date on that, and the company was still owned at that time by the Review Publishing Company. Then it changed hands later on, right?
In 1967, D.A. Peterson Incorporated was given the opportunity of buying the radio stations. Donald Peterson had been president of the Review Publishing Company. The Review had sold its was selling its interests in the newspaper and was about to divest itself of other properties, but they gave Don Peterson a chance to buy it. So in 1967, D.A. Peterson, Inc. became owners of both stations.
Now, how did he get involved in the radio station to have this opportunity to purchase the station? Did he work at the station or at the Review?
Well, he had earlier been the manager of the radio stations in 53 to 59. Prior to that, Frank Hoyles, young Frank, Frank Jr., had been manager from 1949 to 1953. But later on, Don Peterson became president of the Review Publishing Company as well. And that's why he had the opportunity to buy the stations.
And then you became manager in what year, Tony?
1960.
And in 1967, the station changed hands, became owned by D.A. Peterson Incorporated. The next significant event, I would think, would probably be the addition of the stereo to the FM station.
Well, stereo was becoming big with FM along about the time that D.A. Peterson bought it. And so we began to make plans immediately for adding stereo to our FM. So in July 1, 1967, we finished all the work that was necessary and started on FM stereo.
Now this also split the programming. prior to this, the programming on AM and FM was the same.
Right. We at the same time automated the FM so that we could split and play different kind of music on FM because it was stereo. We had to. We couldn't play the regular mono music on it since it was already stereo. So we separated the programming most of the time. Mm-hmm. Not all the time. We stayed on together in the morning for about 4 hours, I think. And then split away.
Mm-hmm. And then more automation came in later years on the AM side of things.
In 1972, we decided to automate the AM as well, and that created a further split in our programming between AM and FM. So that now we are combined only for news, sports, and special features. All the music is separate.
Let's talk a little bit about the music from 1947 up to the present time here in 1976.
Well, of course, in 1947, Dick, it was all big band sound.
Mm-hmm.
And our libraries were full of the big band music, and so much different from today. People liked little insignificant songs like Mersey Doats and Dozy Doats and
Little Lambsy
Dozy. All right. Songs of that nature, and they liked the Andrews Sisters. And what a change, though, from today with the more what I call the beat music.
Mm-hmm.
The melody is gone, the beat has come to the fore. When we first started on the air, it was melody that counted a good deal. Well, that wasn't all true entirely, but mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And today it's mostly beat music, I call it.
In the mid-50s, mid and late 50s, rock and roll became a significant part of the music scene. Did WFAH get involved in that at all?
We tried a few times, but it didn't work. There was one Cleveland station that seemed to have all the rock audience. And no matter what one would try to do, he couldn't fight it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went back away from it for a time.
I remember you had some actually broadcast live from some of the schools with the Coca-Cola as the sponsor.
Yeah, we did that. Which, speaking of live broadcasts, when we first went on the air, we had a lot of live programs right out of the studio, too. And anybody that had a little bit of talent was invited to come in. We didn't pay anybody, you understand, except Tony Rose, who was our staff pianist. And we put 15-minute, half-hour, hour programs together. Oh, we had game-type shows that we ran, give away prizes. We'd ask questions, you know, and I remember bringing in a litter of pups one Saturday morning for a live studio audience, and anybody that answered these questions right would get a pup. I was glad to get rid of the pups, you know.
I thought maybe they'd answer all the questions wrong.
It was kind of interesting.
Do you recall some of the people who entertained live on the radio?
I'm afraid to start mentioning any because I might skip somebody. But I do recall we had such things as the Carpenter Sisters from Sebring. We had a harmonica quartet from Mount Union College. Al Nash was a member of that harmonica quartet, and they were good, too. They really played good stuff. Well, we had a polka band from Salem, Coran was his name, and I think Dale Wright was a member of that organization for a while. They came in on Sundays and had a big time.
Now, Dale Wright has a polka show now, but of course it's all done with records.
With records, right.
Also, I recall him as a youngster, I always enjoyed the Story Lady.
Yeah, we had that on Saturday morning, and we'd give ice cream and cookies to the kids from the sponsors, and the Story Lady would read stories to the children. That was a big thing today. Wouldn't it be interesting? You couldn't get three children out to hear a story hour, I don't think.
Not today, I'm afraid. So most of the early programming, or a lot of it, was live. We're talking about music, and I think we left off in the 1950s with the rock. Would you say during the 60s music was pretty well adult-oriented type of thing, programming?
Yes, I would very definitely say it was until about mid-60s, starting out. And then it began to go more to the teenagers, right? Until today, REM is strictly teenage music.
And when the split came between the two stations, then one went clean towards adults
Sort
and one went.
of what we call wall-to-wall kind of programming and music that something anybody can listen to and not get too upset about it.
I think WFAH was involved in some early experiments with stereo. I don't know what year that would have been, but maybe you could.
Well, Frank Hoyles was station manager at that time, and we had
That would have been the early 50s then, probably.
yes, I'm sure it was. I don't really know what time. But we did set up a program where you could tune your AM station and your FM station and get the stereo effect. And
Got half the program on AM and the other half on FM.
that's right. That's right. And boy, we had some big advertising on it, just how to go about doing this, you know. Yeah, it was experimental, and but not until stereo records became important did stereo really take hold. Well, the only time when we were experimenting with it, we had to buy tape, and that's the only kind of music was available for stereo.
Earlier, when we were talking about the Breakfast with Your Neighbor program, you said once in a while you taped that program, but I don't think you taped it, did you? You recorded it, probably.
We had paper tape, and
Ah.
earliest recorders that we had were wire. And they were a mess because if the wire broke or anything happened to the machine, you'd have nothing but spaghetti. It was springy. And that wasn't very satisfactory, those wire recorders. And then the Brush Company came out with a tape, which was they used paper back tape with some kind of coating on it. And but we cut a lot of records too. We had two record cutting machines. And we did a lot of those. In fact, we still have some of those old records we cut here on file. Not many. We couldn't save them all because they were heavy and very difficult.
So it moved from the wire to the paper and then to the Mylar and on
Right.
to where we are today.
Right.
And I don't know what we'd do without that tape
Yeah, I
today.
don't either.
Maybe you could explain a little bit about the automation and what that does for the station as far as the staff is concerned, and then what it does for the listener too, because there's some very good advantages to the automation.
Well, there are very few stations that are as highly automated as we are. I'm talking about for on-air production. Both our AM and our FM are automated, practically 100%. Of course, the news is live, and certain broadcasts are live, but fully automated, and this is done by computer. We have a memory which we have fed certain information and which pushes buttons for us, so to speak. Automation with the advent of the cartridge tape, which people are familiar with, I'm sure, because they have them in the homes. But with the advent of cartridge tape, it became possible for us to record practically all of our commercial announcements ahead of time so that there wasn't an opportunity for a flub on the air. Furthermore, you could give it more time for production. You might want to add some music or sound effects and so forth. And with the cartridge tape, you can do a lot of this. Get it perfect. If it's not right the first time, you erase the cartridge and start over and do it right. So I think this has been a tremendous thing for the public in that now they get a perfect spot every time rather than a flub. And they get more interesting kind of spots. So that was the start of it. But then it became possible for a man to sit in the studio and push buttons. He'd push a button to play a record, he'd push a button to play a spot, he'd push a button for this and a button for that. And so we say, why do we need this guy sitting in there spilling his coffee over his copy? Why not put him to work somewhere else and doing some good production? So we automated. A machine can push buttons quite as well as a person. and sometimes better. We get better control, and it just has been tremendous all the way.